I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, March 18, 2004. Clerk, would you take the roll, please?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Anderson. Blaine. Ellison. Fuller.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Lesh. Littman. Meslow.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Paymar.
Here.
Hall. Rhodes.
Soderstrom.
Strand.
Tao.
Walz.
I gotta look at my calendar.
Okay, we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll delay the minutes here till later in the meeting. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 2585. Representative Smith, do you want to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 2585 and request that after hearing it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, the bill is before us. Proceed with testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 2585, I have two presenters here this morning. I'll briefly tell you what it does. I'll let them flesh it out. It increases, if passed, the surcharge imposed on indexing or recording deeds and instruments such as filing an abstract of title, filing certain other documents related to real property, and the surcharge would be increased from $5 to $7. The purpose would be to provide additional funding for civil legal services. Let me ask. I'd ask Mr. Dorfman to add a little to that presentation, then we can stand for questions.
Okay, Mr. Dorfman, you want to state your name for the record and proceed?
Sure. Glenn Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Mr. Chairman and members, we started back in the 80s when Chief Justice Sandy Keith asked us to, in legislative lobbying terms, take a walk, meaning the Chief Justice wanted some money for the courts. He needed money for legal aid, and he was a major proponent. And on a bipartisan basis ever since, as you might imagine, legal aid is not a high priority in the stream of legislative thinking. You're not bad to them, but it's not a high priority. So we have formed sort of an alliance with legal aid over the years, and that alliance is that these gentlemen and ladies are relatively low-paid attorneys who provide legal assistance to the poorest Minnesotans. And through modest increases in the real estate filing fees, they get the legal protections that the rest of us take for granted. The $2 is, again, a fairly modest increase. The real estate market is has been robust. It will be slowing somewhat after interest rates start to rise after the presidential election. But we think that the and we're checking very carefully to make sure that the fiscal note is accurate. But we'd favor, of course, long-term, the establishment of some sort of long-term funding so that legal aid can get their money. The most important piece of this is the nexus. Some of you may want to know how we arrived at a nexus here, and that was arrived at because about 25% to 35% of legal aid's work is done in real estate-related matters, rental housing and residential housing. So that's how we established the nexus between the fee and the funding, the services, I'm sorry. So I certainly will stand for any questions.
Do we have any questions from the committee? No questions?
Comment.
Do you want to make a comment, Representative Paymar?
Well, I just want to say I somewhat take exception with Mr. Dorfman's claim that the legislature doesn't see legal aid as being a high priority. Members of this committee have long felt that legal aid is a high priority, very important to low-income people in this state, and members of this committee have tried very hard to get adequate funding for legal aid, so just want to say that for the record.
Any other comments? Anyone in the audience that wants to comment or make testimony on the bill? Mr. Beneke?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will be very brief. I just want to, first of all, express my thanks to this committee for its strong support of the justice partnership we have in Minnesota. This committee has been very supportive and fair to legal aid over the years and to access to justice, and I know many of you do it pro bono or in the community in addition to your work in this committee on a bipartisan basis. Also express my appreciation to the Minnesota Realtors because legal aid has faced a severe funding cut, and back in 1992 and 93 when this happened on two other occasions, the Realtors came to help legal aid so that we could at least keep up. This increase would allow us to not go all the way back to where we were before the cuts came, but would take allow us on a statewide basis to take a step forward. So again, I'm happy to answer questions, and I've given information to Representative Smith, but we in the legal aid community, including Mr. Lane, my colleague out here, Nancy Kleeman from the State Bar Association, are very appreciative of this committee's work and your support, and allows us to help, you know, between our individual casework and our community work, at least 70,000 Minnesotans each year from all 87 counties. So thank you.
Okay, if there's no further comment or questions, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
We do have a quorum now, so Representative Tao, have you had a chance to read the minutes? Okay, Representative Tao would move that the minutes be approved as written. Any additions or corrections or comments? All those in favor of moving the minutes as they are presented, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes are passed. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2363. Welcome, Representative McNamara. I would
just go into the where's the bill going?
Ways and Means.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've removed the fiscal note from the bill when we moved the amendment, so I believe it could go to the general register. There is no fiscal impact in the bill.
Okay, then I would move that move House File 2363 be passed and move to the general register on the House floor. Representative McNamara, won't you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today with me is Jay Rendell from the DNR. He's the Aquatic Species Program Coordinator at the DNR. And, Mr. Chair, would you like us to move Amendment A4 to get the bill in the form we'd like?
Yes, just one moment.
Certainly.
Chair would move AO4-1152 to get the bill in the shape that the author would like, and then let's do that if there's no objection. So the author can proceed. In favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Rendell from the DNR, and he can explain the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, I'm Jay Rendell, the DNR Exotic Species Program Coordinator. I think the reason that we're here today is because of the provision on that the amendment pertained to on page 16 that would make some of the activities related to prohibited exotic species a gross misdemeanor. Those would be essentially the most likely to be intentional activities, such as the sale and propagation and import of those species. We think this is reasonable because right now the sale of game and fish, which are not necessarily harmful species, are a gross misdemeanor, and so we think at least it ought to be equivalent for things that could be a real detriment to our ecosystems and recreation. The provision that was in the bill on civil penalties has now been removed by the amendment, so that should no longer be an issue.
Any questions from the committee of Mr. Rendall? Any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on House File 2363? Could you raise your hand, please? I see nobody. So we're back then to the committee for discussion. I don't see any. Want to, Cheryl, Representative Eastland, renew your motion?
Yes, I renew the motion to bill pass and order the generation.
Representative Eastland renews his motion. House File 2363, as amended, be recommended to pass. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. House File 2586, Representative Cornish. All right, excuse me, 2537, Representative Boudreaux.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Chair will move House File 2537. Recommended to pass. It's before the committee. Go ahead.
And I believe, Mr. Chairman, it would go to the floor.
Correct.
To the general register.
That's correct.
And, just to inform members what the bill is about, first of all, adverse health reporting system is the system of reporting adverse events. Mainly it existed with hospitals. We passed that last year about procedures that hopefully we can improve on those adverse events. This bill actually makes some modifications to that system that was passed last year. It also, first of all, the bill, when passed, required hospitals to report incidents that are never supposed to happen to the Department of Health. It's actually an agency bill for the Board of Medical Practice, and it makes some modifications to that law as well as expanding it a bit to other health-related licensing boards. I believe, Mr. Chairman, you requested it here because you possibly had a question about a particular section.
Well, Representative Boudreaux, I think if you will look at pages 6 and 7, sections 10 and 11, and just describe what those two sections do, and I think that would complete my focus on your bill.
Well, Section 10 deals with immunity. It actually exempts a specific board of pharmacy associates from liability and prosecution relating to reporting adverse health care events. And then Section 11 exempts the specific board of podiatry associates from liability and prosecution relating to reporting adverse health care events.
Any questions from the committee of the author on the bill in general or those two sections in specific? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Boudreaux, is this just added as an oversight because other groups were given immunity in the original bill, or are they given special consideration here?
Representative Boudreaux.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Powell, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask the Board of Medical Practice to answer that question because I do not have that information.
The gentleman is coming down. If you'll take a seat and give us your name for the record and then respond to the question, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Auld. I'm the Assistant Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. This language was created during the drafting process of this bill at the suggestion of the Assistant Attorney General that represents the Board of Medical Practice, for the purpose of extending the immunity provisions that exist in existing law to the activities covered by this bill. And the process involved suggestions from the Attorney General's office and the researcher who was doing the drafting. And the intent was to extend existing immunity provisions to this activity.
Representative Powell, anything further?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess specifically, just so I feel better, the specific question is, are these two carved out for special consideration, or are they now being brought in under the same umbrella as other boards?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell, my understanding is the latter is the case.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Very good. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman, if the language needs better or further clarification, I'd be willing to work on that as this moves to the General Register, but I think the intent is not to exempt anybody from immunity, or, you know, give them immunity. It's just about collecting this data.
Anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on House File 2537, raise your hand. Come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Twilight Liberation Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I have spoken with Representative Boudreau about this concern that continues to be problematic for us. And since this is judicial legal issues in this committee, if you'll turn to page 2, lines 15 to 22, and in particular, the first word of line 20, which talks about an agreement between the state of Minnesota and the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We are very concerned with the idea that we are putting into statute an agreement whose language has not been requested that we know of from any committee, whose language we have not seen, and the language which could change next week, next month, next year. So the question is, why are we putting into statute an agreement that no one has seen and that can change? It would seem to me that we should have those words available for the public to see what exactly is being agreed to and what's being put into law. And there should be some sort of liability even with this, but we don't even know what it is. It could mean that the information could be reported to other agencies, worldwide agencies, national agencies, state, or reports could be made with individual names on them and sent. We don't know because we don't know what's in the agreement. That's our concern.
Representative Boudreau, would you review for us this discussion at Health and Human Services Committee level?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Ms. Braze just has had maybe a couple of different multiple objections to some of the provisions in this bill. And to this specific one, I would have to have someone from the department or from the Board of Medical Practice address it.
Representative Boudreau and Ms. Brace, just a personal opinion, it's part of the bill and we can discuss it. I think that the two sections that this committee that I wanted to look at, we've discussed, and I haven't seen any further questions. So unless there's further testimony or questions on this particular item in page 2, I think we're going to move along.
Mr. Chairman, to the provision that Ms. Braze mentions, the explanation and the overview from House Research just simply says that it adds the Commissioner of Health and the Director of the Office of Health Facility Complaints to the list of agencies that are exempt from investigating an adverse health care event. It clarifies their reporting requirements, and I don't know that there's any more to that, but...
But Mr. Chair,
Ms. Brace, did you testify on this issue and bring it up in Health and Human Services Committee?
Yes.
Okay, and it was discussed there, and it was left in the bill there. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It is a bad precedent to put in an agreement, which is, when you look at law, you know what you're getting. Even when you look at the rules, you know what you're getting. But when you have the words "an agreement," you don't know what you're getting, and it's a very bad precedent. To say agreement, we don't even know what you're passing. So,
any further questions of the author on this House file?
Mr. Chairman, I could just clear this up. It's the agreement to inspect hospitals through the Medicare requirement. Hospitals are required to do that, so that is what it's referring to. That's the Council for Hospitals that provided that information for me.
All right. Is there anyone else wanting to be heard on this bill? Raise your hand. I don't see any. The bill then is before the committee for discussion. On the chair's motion that House File 2537 be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Boudreau, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
House File 2586, Representative Cornish, immunity from liability provided for school district and district employees. Chair moves that House File 2586 be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. Bill is before us. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that went through civil law the other day, and in layman's terms, what it is in 2003, legislation was passed to mandate that a school had to notify teachers and other district employees about the violent offenders within their school or a student with a violent behavior, a history of it. What made it very problematic for schools was the things that in the legislation that weren't addressed and increased the liability and exposure both criminally and civilly to the school district. And this is brought for me to this from the school districts. And several of the problems are, the first one, that school districts are hesitant to adopt the policy and procedures because of potential legal action, either by staff members who do not receive notification or by students who are labeled as a history of violent offenses. Now, what this means is the school district has many, many employees, and it's not defined in what a school district employee means. It's teachers, bus drivers, substitute teachers. There's many employees, and if they should even make a good faith effort to notify everybody and miss one, they're worried about liability criminally and civilly. The existing law does not specify the definition of a student with violent history. Doesn't say what that is, and they're also required to notify the parent that they have a violent student as a child. They're worried about that notification, labeling somebody with that. The existing law does not specify which school staff members have an educational interest. If it's every teacher in the building and every substitute, and also they're worried about the privacy rights. So the school has asked, the school district asked that the legislation be forwarded that would, if they made a reasonable good faith effort to notify each school district employee, that they could be held immune from liability or civil, administrative, or criminal action. Now, in the last committee, we fixed this up a little bit. We found out that the last year's legislation didn't actually require the school to adopt a policy. All they did was were furnished with a model policy, but the school district wasn't required to adopt it. So the committee chair actually had a problem with having it both ways. First of all, they weren't required to adopt a policy, and then they were asking for immunity. So in a trade-off, we amended this in our last committee. Now the school districts would be required to adopt a policy, and they would have to notify, but they were asking in return for immunity from civil criminal liability in this legislation if they made a good faith effort. Because there's a lot of things in the bill that aren't introduced or aren't specifically addressed. I have with me Gray Schwab from the School Boards Association if you need to answer any technical questions.
Are there any questions from the committee at this time of the author, Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, was there an incident that brought this bill about? An actual thing? Or is it a what-if?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I don't believe so. There was just that the problem was 50% of the schools were adopting policies, 50% of the schools weren't. The ones that weren't were telling the schools that did that they were exposing themselves to liability if they did. So there was a lot of confusion. Now the law has been changed in the last committee to require all districts to adopt this policy. but in return they're asking for immunity because they're worried about potential exposure that would exist in the future. So it's a what if, you read.
Any further questions? Is anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on House File 2586? Could you raise your hand, please? I see nobody. Well, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I was going to wait until the other the testifier went, but I'll ask my question now.
Go ahead.
Representative Cornish, have you had an opportunity to talk with Teachers Union about this, Education Minnesota, or any labor organization representing teachers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, yes, I did, and the lobbyist for the Education Minnesota was there. They didn't give it their blessing, but they were tracking it, and I think if they would have had a problem with it, they would have showed up today because they've been tracking it right along but have not opposed it.
Mr. Chair, Ellison. You know, I'm still trying to make up my mind about how I feel about your bill. I will share with you my concern. Maybe you can react to it if you care to. My thought is that, you know, there's a difference between it basically allows a school district, as I read your bill, to be negligent as it relates to sharing information about violent students. And if it, because the negligence defined as here's a standard that everybody abides by and you didn't do that, the school didn't do it by giving the notice. They basically can do that under your bill, but what they couldn't do is perhaps knowingly withhold information about a violent student when that information was in their possession. Because good faith, to me, is a lower standard than negligence or carelessness. Good faith, to say that somebody didn't act in good faith, you got to basically say they acted in bad faith. And what does it mean to act in bad faith? It means that, you know, we knew that we had a violent kid coming to your class, but we didn't tell you about it because we didn't want to. Now, if I have a misunderstanding of the way this bill would work, it would be great for you to help me see this thing a little clearer. But as I understand it, it would allow the school board to not give the kind of care that they should when it comes to notifying teachers about who's in their class. So that's my thoughts, and maybe clear it up for me.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the way I see this working, and you're several attorneys on board here, you probably have a better explanation, but good faith effort means good faith. They would have to have challenged proof that they made a good faith effort. And the old, as you know, in trial law, I suppose the reasonable person definition or good faith effort, it would be examined, and if they didn't make a good faith effort, they could still be held accountable. So I think it ties them down pretty good. It still gives them some flexibility because there's literally hundreds of employees. They miss a substitute somewhere. They're, you know, it's just a way out for them to some of the exposure.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, what happens to the kid that has a history of violence but has gone through treatment and help so that they are no longer violent? Does that record still have to follow that child?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I really couldn't answer that. The technicalities, I think that's some of the problems in the statute.
Let's see. This gentleman at the table, would give us your name and address the question.
I'm Charlie Kite. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and I can answer that question. What the present law says is that if a student is identified as violent, every employee who has contact with that student must be notified for the following 2 years. So let's say a student did go through a treatment program. There would still have to be some notification that would go for a period of 2 years.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kite, I guess that was my problem because I was, it's the present law. I remember I was kind of doubtful about the present law, too. Now we're establishing a policy, Representative Cornish, that says that every school's got to have the same or a policy, and then every employee has to be notified. And I'm not sure that all that's necessary, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Representative Murphy.
No.
All right.
Just going to wrap.
Further discussion? Any? If not, the chair renews his motion that House File 2363 be recommended to pass, be transferred, excuse me, wrong number, 2586, be recommended to pass, be transferred to General Register. If there's no further discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
Representative Strawn, House File 2976, Fugitive Apprehension Unit. Give us your motion, and then we'll proceed.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask you or Mr. Matzik, I believe that the 2976 missed deadline, so do I need to refer that to rules? I'll make a motion to recommend it pass and refer to rules.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this bill has to do with the Department of Corrections, and some of you know this, some of you may not, but the Department of Corrections has an Office of Special Investigations who work with fugitives from the Department of Corrections, and they are, and Director Gerlicher will talk briefly about the content of what they're asking, but this is enabling them to forfeit certain property, not including real property, by the way. And although this has to do with forfeitures, it is very specific to DOC. And I should mention that I have spoken with both Representative Fuller and Representative Latz, who were intimately involved in forfeiture issues last session, and they are both fine with the bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll have Director Gerlicher speak.
Give us your name and then go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Carrie Gerlicher. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair, what this revision of the forfeiture law does is it allows the Minnesota Department of Corrections law enforcement unit to partake in asset forfeitures as other law enforcement agencies in this state does. We've written this bill very narrowly to not include real property or motor vehicles. A lot of the forfeiture laws that deal with the seizure of motor vehicles and those sorts of things have to do with long narcotics cases or prostitution cases. The law enforcement unit for the Department of Corrections does not have the ability to execute search warrants. We do not go out and do proactive law or narcotics investigations. We deal specifically with warranted Department of Corrections fugitives. We have incidents maybe five or six times a year where during that arrest the fugitive may be in possession of some quantity of a narcotic like crack cocaine and cash. And normally what happens now is after our investigators spend two or three weeks trying to find this individual and arrest them with the local law enforcement agency, all of the asset forfeiture proceeds are going to the law enforcement agency that came in and did purely the apprehension. And we would like to be able to participate in those seizure forfeiture dollars as well.
Any questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Strawn, I'm just curious how this actually works. And the forfeiture pie is only so big, presumably, so the DOC gets a piece of the action, then who's become smaller then?
Representative Strawn.
Mr. Chair, short answer is local law enforcement, but this is, in very specific cases that only pertain to cases that are conducted almost entirely by DOC. So in other words, municipal or local law enforcement's participation is minimal and really involved just in the execution of the warrant.
Any further questions from the committee? Is there anyone present who wants to be heard on this bill, House File 2976? Could you raise your hand, please? I don't see anyone. Question is before committee then. On the bill, Representative Strawn renews his motion, House File 2976, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Seeing no discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. House File 1593, Representative Strawn, why don't you retain your seat there at the table?
I can sit over here.
Or you can move to the other chair if you wish. Take up your next bill. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1593 be referred to, I believe we can go to the General Register.
That's correct. Bill is before us. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I will be brief once again. This has to do with, you may have heard of the Monkeys and Lions Bill. This is the Monkeys and Lions and Tigers Bill.
If you ask me, I'm going to tell you the same thing I told you in the Ag Committee, or told the Ag Committee. If you ask me a year and a half ago when I ran for office, was Strand will help regulate monkeys and lions and tigers. That, believe it or not, was not on my literature when I ran. I didn't know that it would be an issue, but the fact is this is not an animal rights bill. It's a public safety bill. It addresses a serious public safety concern, and the problem is the growing number of dangerous exotic wild animals in the hands of private owners in Minnesota. Believe it or not, a lot of people don't know this, but there is no regulation of wild animals like monkeys, lions, tigers, bears in the state of Minnesota. This is one of those topics, as some of you may know, members, that is a very, it's a hot button issue for certain people on either side of the issue. And I've certainly learned that in carrying this bill, by the way. In doing that, we have reached a compromise. And in fact, there are no amendments today because there's been so much hard work on behalf of Representative Lindgren, who had a different bill than I did, and myself, to reach the point where no one is really entirely happy with the bill, which is probably indicative of the fact that it's a good bill and a strong bill. Mr. Chairman and members, before Representative Lindgren speaks for just a second, with your permission, I would just like to mention that there should be in your packets a small sampling of pictures from USDA licensed facilities in Minnesota, as well as a number of letters in support of the bill, some articles, and a small sampling of the hundreds of ads of the internet and publication and newspapers where people can purchase these animals. It's estimated that right now there's about 15,000 tigers privately owned in the United States. They're easy to buy. They bring these pets sometimes to quote-unquote pets to schools, parks, and shopping malls. We're all probably familiar with the Siegfried and Roy Horn incident, where I think that's indicative again of the fact that wild animals will almost always revert to their wild state and the danger that they present. I will give a tremendous amount of credit to the breeders and the operators of these businesses in Minnesota. They have indicated that yes, there should be regulation, and that the bad operators shouldn't be in business, and that's why they've worked so hard on this bill. It's a solid bill, and the last thing I'll say before asking Representative Lindgren to speak briefly is there's recently been a federal prohibition on interstate sales of these types of animals, particularly lions and tigers, which makes it even more important that we get ahead of the curve and regulate these animals before, because of the fact that they're harder to transfer between states. Minnesota sort of has so many of these within our state that it becomes a larger problem. With that, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd have Representative Lindgren.
Representative Lindgren, give us your name again, and go ahead.
Chairman, thank you. Members, I am Doug Lindgren, and like Mr. Strand has indicated, this has been kind of a compromise and truly a cooperative effort between both parties. The bill that I had, we brought together Rome, which is a group of breeders, and they wanted regulation, and they wanted to take care of this challenge that they've been faced with. And like Mr. Strand has said, this has been, both sides have compromised. And so nobody's truly happy with the bill, but they believe it's something that they can live with. And they, like I said, they have, both sides have compromised to get to the point where we are right now, and we think this is a good bill. That's all, Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on House File 1593, could you raise your hand now, please? There are none. Questions? Representative Paymar, and then Murphy. Paymar, Representative Paymar.
I appreciate the fact that there was cooperation and compromise, but I'd like to know what was compromised out of the bill.
Sure. Mr. Chair?
Representative Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, thanks for the question. You're right, it is a compromise. What was compromised out of the bill, and I'll speak briefly about it, and Tammy Quist from Wildcat Sanctuary can get more specific if I didn't cover all of it. Private owners of lions and tigers can replace their animals one time. That was a compromise. Private owners of monkeys and bears can indefinitely replace their animals. That was a compromise. And the level of regulation and the type of regulation that breeders and operators have is not as strict as it originally was in the bill that I had. Is that an accurate statement? Okay. Is there anything that I didn't cover?
Let's say
oh.
Let's have direct conversation for the record. Because years from now, when we're worried about reviewing the history of this bill, who was you talking to on the side? I wonder.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'll have Tammy Quist cover any other areas that I missed.
Give us your name and then respond.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tammy Quist, and I'm with the Wildcat Sanctuary. In addition to the comments that were mentioned, this also allows current dealers and exhibitors, people that have these animals for business purposes, to increase their inventory 25% so they can maintain current inventory for exhibiting purposes and for selling to other USDA facilities and zoos.
With Representative Paymar.
So I'm just trying to, why are we, it just sounds like we're maintaining the status quo rather than phasing out what obviously is a problem in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually this bill does not allow new private owners that do not currently have pets to buy tigers, lions, or servals, bears in the future. So it's grandfathering current owners and current breeders and exhibitors.
And Mr. Chair, why are we doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, it is not ideal. And I think really to put it very bluntly, at one end of the curve was severe limitations, which would limit the market very severely and very quickly, and in fact eliminate the market relatively quickly. At the other end was complete lack of regulation, and I think we're somewhere in the middle. That's really where we're ending up.
And Mr. Chair, is there anyone here, is Nancy Minion or anyone here from the... I guess before I vote on it, I'd like to know whether that... the compromise has been agreed to by everyone.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I think the goal of the bill is to shrink the population in the hands of private owners who have these dangerous animals as pets over time, and I think that's what the compromise bill does versus a sudden prohibition tomorrow, et cetera.
Representative Paymar, help me understand as well. The lady in the audience, that there was some silent repartee between you and her. Would she come forward and tell us your thoughts on who are you and what are your thoughts on this bill? Please, ma'am. I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I just would like your input.
My name is Nancy Minion, and I'm a citizen working on the bill. And in answer to Representative Paymar's question, Mr. Chairman and committee members, yes, this is a compromise bill. It's not perfect for either side. But we did agree to compromise on this language.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Questions, Representative Murphy, then Fuller, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Strawn, Representative Lindgren. Well, thank you for your work on this and for doing this. The original bill had signage, like down at the bottom of the driveway or someplace on the outer limits of the property of the individuals, and I really like that, but that's no longer here, and I understand about compromises, but will you tell me what happened with the signs?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Strawn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, and you're right, that was a compromise, and the result, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's the signage needs to be in any enclosure or any area where the animal might be, including the house. And that's for public safety reasons. If an officer or somebody is approaching the house, or goes into the house. And again, that was compromised language.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Strawn, is it just one sign then, or is there a sign on the enclosure and the house, or is a sign of a certain size?
Ms. Quist.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now the size is not dictated, but the bill language states that where an animal is kept in an enclosure or if the animal is a pet and kept in the house, that's where the signage would be. So anybody entering that area would know that there is a regulated animal on premise.
Before they came in contact.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fuller?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Strand, I was sorry to see Representative Lindgren stepped out, but wanted to let committee members know that as your bill was originally introduced, I had big problems with it. It would have, members, shut down a place up in my district called Paul Bunyan Animal Land, which has tigers, and, you know, they, I believe, have roughly 10,000 people a year come through. They're almost our little zoo up in Bemidji. And I guess the question that I was going to propose to Representative Lindgren, and I bet Representative Strand can now answer it, is, well, first of all, this compromise is good, but the regulation that these people are already under from the USDA is absolutely incredible. I spent a couple hours there going through some of the paperwork and learning about this issue, and I think the compromise is good. I hope the Senate author, Senator Betzold, will stick to that. He is pursuing this issue with a bit more vigor, and I don't think has been as open to the compromise as you've been, Representative Strand, and I commend you for that, because there's one thing about regulating some of these animals and getting at the people in the private sector, you know, private citizens with these animals, and it's different for those that currently are regulated by the USDA. This bill would have had them tagging and putting under anesthesia all their animals, which there's a high rate of death once you do that, and some big problems with it for those small operators. And so I commend the compromise. But just to give the committee an idea, maybe just tell us a little bit about some of the paperwork that they have to go through in order, you know, for those operators, what they have to go through just to stay in operation and the inspections they go through.
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you based on the bill or based on USDA standards?
The current USDA standards, that is part of the reason for the compromise, Mr. Chair, is, you know, this bill is getting away from leaving those folks, you know, somewhat alone.
You know, in terms of USDA standards, it's really, you have to file for a pre-license agreement. To have a USDA license, you have to be commercially using the animal, either breeding it and selling it to the public or to other facilities, or exhibiting it in schools, roadside zoos, being open to the public zoo. A pre-inspection is done. Again, there is some inherent good and pros and cons of USDA, because it's up to that agent to decide whether that facility is up to par. So there are great facilities like the one you're speaking of, but there are other facilities that aren't meeting current minimum standards based on what you've seen in your packets. So there are inspections, there are veterinary care programs that they have to follow. There are certain requirements, like a perimeter fence that needs to be around the facility. So USDA compliant facilities are meeting standards of care. Non-compliant that still hold licenses are the ones that we're hoping this bill will help as well.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up, with this compromise, those that are in compliance are going to be able to continue to operate, and the compromise is trying to get at those that aren't.
Correct.
Is that a correct statement?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anyone in the audience wanting to testify on House File 1593, could you raise your hand, please? I don't see anyone. So the question then is back before the committee. Your motion?
Renew my motion to pass House File 1593 to the House floor.
If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next item will be House File 2217. Representative Meslow, vehicles required to wait at railroad crossings. And do you have a motion on this?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I am moving that House File 2217 pass and be referred to the General Register.
He doesn't put something.
All right. The bill is before us. Tell us about it, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is something that makes something a violation of the law that I think most of us probably already thought was a violation of the law.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, certainly.
Just for the committee's benefit, what we're doing now is passing out those bills that are on our agenda that we did not think we would get to today. And looks like we might yet this morning. And if we do, then we don't have to come back after session. So just as a little interruption here, since we're being interrupted by the passing out, I thought I'd also tell us what we're doing. Representative Meslow, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll do what I can to keep us moving along. It is a violation of current law in Minnesota. Right now, Minnesota law says that when you approach the railroad tracks, you've got to stop and make sure it's safe before you go forward. However, it doesn't address a situation that can occur, for example, in White Bear Lake. We've got railroad tracks that parallel Highway 61, which is one of the main thoroughfares through town. And depending upon where you're trying to cross Highway 61, there may be room for zero or for one or for two cars between the railroad tracks and Highway 61. So cars proceed across those tracks, but sometimes are stopped for the stoplight and are left there straddling the railroad tracks. Strangely enough, that's legal. That's what we're trying to change here. We actually had a situation in White Bear Lake where that happened and someone was hit by a train as it came by. All we're doing with this law is establishing that not only do you have to make sure that it's safe to proceed across the tracks, but you have to be able to get across the tracks and 10 feet beyond in order to proceed across those tracks. It's really as simple as that.
Any questions from the committee on this particular bill? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. I believe that we have one intersection that abuts my district. There's the railroad crossing that's Accurate, and then it goes down a small hill, and then the stoplight is right there. I don't know that there is enough room for one car and 10 feet. What happens in those instances? I'm not certain if it would trigger the light if people are waiting on the other side, or what about those instances?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I can't speak to how they've got the light set to trigger at that particular intersection. Under current law, it's up for grabs. Under this amendment, if the light is red, the first car would need to stop behind the railroad tracks. The railroad tracks would essentially be a part of the intersection.
Representative Hillstrom, we're still with you, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that, in fact, that it doesn't cause a problem for this particular intersection that abuts my district, because, again, it's been that way for a long, long time, and I don't know that there is 10 feet and a car length beyond the railroad tracks, and I'm not certain where the pads are, so maybe if you'd be open to considering amendment later, if we pass this bill, you know, to address those circumstances, if that's a problem, I'm happy to work with you on it.
Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, I just can't help but think that there's all kinds of situations that would also be affected by this. Tell me if your bill doesn't affect this. In a situation where the track isn't that close to a stoplight or to something, but there's the accordion effect of cars, and so you're driving along and all of a sudden you're there and the one in front of you stops and you're there. Now you're, again, nobody wants to stop in the middle of a track. I mean, I don't think nobody wants to do that, but I mean, we're gonna create a situation where people are going to be guilty of some kind of a breaking the law, and all they were doing was just following in traffic, and all of a sudden, because of the way the traffic stops, they're just left in the middle of a track. And I guess it seems like that's kind of an unintended consequence, or is that addressed in the bill?
Representative Maslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I guess I'd say that actually that would be an intended consequence of the bill, because what we're really talking about is the safety of the driver and passengers in the vehicle that otherwise would be straddling the track. And if what we've got is a red stoplight up ahead, I would hope that the driver would be alert to the fact that the light was red and that cars were stopping in front. And just as a vehicle, just as a driver wouldn't stop in the middle of an intersection because the light happens to be because traffic is backed up with that accordion effect, that drivers would do the same and say, we're not going to stop on the tracks here. We'll make sure we're behind the tracks.
Senator Beasley.
I guess that's kind of the question. I don't think anybody wants to stop in the middle of a track, and I think people avoid that at virtually all expenses right now. And I guess if there's some inevitable situations where it's probably going to still happen, and people are trying to avoid those situations already, does it accomplish anything to make it against the law? I guess I'm failing to see kind of the connection here. Because I mean, I wouldn't want to stop in the middle of a track, but there's times where I've been caught there.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, in that sense, this is not different from a lot of other laws. Most of us wouldn't intend to drive through red lights either, and we've probably had circumstances where we mistimed it and we caught it, and that's what happened. I think it's important that there are laws that set out what it is that we're supposed to do. We all know that there are times that those traffic laws are violated. I don't think this is different than any of the others. The traffic laws are about safety, and I think this is certainly a safety issue, and I think the law would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
What's the consequence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, by law, this would be a misdemeanor, which is consistent with the other railroad track violations. How it would be handled in individual jurisdictions would depend upon county and city choices.
Okay, I have Representatives Tao, Paymar, Fuller, and then Hilty, Representative Powell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, I think it's a good bill, but I worry about compliance. Have you considered maybe put a provision in there with signs that will tell what the law is right in front of the railroad track?
Representative Meslow.
No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, every time we make a change to the law, that there is that concern that everybody's not going to be informed on that, but we can't put signs in front of everything that goes on with our other traffic laws, and I think the same thing would be true here, that provides not only expense but clutter and difficulties with that. Again, I go back to what Representative Eastland said earlier, and that is that I think most people are already recognizing that they shouldn't be stopping on the train tracks and are trying to avoid that, and that's what we want. I would not have people, I would not have the state purchasing additional signs to place on, with all respect.
Representative Paymar.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Strand has a question to that point.
I'm sorry?
Representative Strand had a question to that point.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I think...
Representative Fuller yields to Representative Strawn.
Correct.
Representative Strawn.
Mr. Chair, I think I would go over the railroad track reading the sign, so I'm not sure that would be productive. And I choose not to yield to Representative Fuller, Mr. Chair.
The last time I ever yield to Representative Strawn, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
We'll work our way back.
Representative Hilty, would you yield to me?
Pretty soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Meslow, I'm kind of confused now by some of the questions that have been asked about this bill. The impression that I had, certainly stated clearly in the bill summary, is that this only applies to vehicles that are required to stop at railroad crossings. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, there are actually two provisions. If you look at page 2, lines 22 through 24, that refers to the vehicles that are required to stop at all railroad crossings. If you refer to page 1, lines 15 through 18, that would apply to all vehicles, and that indicates that then has broader application.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, this does apply then to any vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, yes.
Well, in that case, then, Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, is there a fiscal note with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, no.
Well, Representative Meslow, wouldn't this entail then changes in the driver's manuals and exams that are given to include this information? Wouldn't there be some cost involved in it?
Perhaps there would be those changes.
Perhaps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, since I'm not an employee of the Department of Public Safety, I'm not sure how they process all that.
Okay, we're going to go to Representative Fuller now, if you're prepared to ask your question. Representative Meslow, before we do that, it strikes me that all this bill does is, right now, you got to stop 10 feet away from a set of tracks, and then if this bill passes, you got to do that. Plus, once you get going, you got to make it 10 feet across the track.
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And don't forget that if you're supposed to stop at the tracks, that you also aren't supposed to shift while you're going over the tracks. I learned that one today, Mr. Chair. And I guess, members, more than any question out there is just a comment of, you know, a lot of this is just pure common sense. If you can't make it across the tracks, don't go across the tracks. It's that simple, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Representative Hill. Yes, Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to get back to the fiscal note piece of this as well. I don't necessarily disagree that this is the safe thing to do, but I would believe that in terms of putting it on exams and changing it, that there is a fiscal note. Possibly we should have that taken a look at or held over? Or?
To that point, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I believe they do the exam change every year, so I'm not... Representative Ford.
That was going to be my point, Mr. Chairman. They, I believe, reprint the exam books every year. I believe the term is it's an inconsequential cost or change, since they're already going to be reprinting the books every year, that this would not force them to have a separate printing of books and whatnot. So I think it would just be an incorporation and inconsequential.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
Well, no.
I would only ask Representative Fuller to come up and present the rest of the bill for me. He's done a much better job than I have.
I don't know if you want me to do that, Representative Mesel. I'm thinking about voting no.
Representative Mesel, you do not want that. Representative Murphy, go ahead.
Chair, Representative Mesel, I think you might want to put an enactment date that coincides with the printing of the pamphlets.
Mr. Debo, what does he need on page 2 to help us move this along?
Mr. Chair, I don't know when the department publishes their program, but we could obviously take a guess if there's someone from DPS.
Or help us out.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Debo, isn't laws, if they don't state an enactment date, becomes August 1st? For all the laws we pass each year, I would gather that Department of Public Safety is smart enough not to go to print until they actually know all the law changes that we enact each year. So I would assume it just would be an automatic without the enactment date being on there.
I'll check it out.
I'm sure Representative Mesel would be happy to make sure that coincides if his bill moves further.
I'll certainly follow up here. Certainly follow up with that, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gilstrom, I will also address your question. I hadn't forgotten.
All right, on House File 2217, Representative Messel renews his motion that bill be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Okay,
we'll cure in doubt. Let's see a show of hands. Those in favor, raise your hands. Okay, lower your hands. Those opposed, raise your hands.
5-5.
There you go.
It's close.
There being 8 ayes and 10 nays, the bill does not pass.
Fair enough.
Which one?
All right, next item will be House File 2259. Representative Blaine. Okay, a motion. You have one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2259. Ask for passage of this bill to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee and be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the bill is before us. Would you walk through it for us?
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is pretty straightforward. And I will go through it for you. Members, the gist of this bill is to increase the penalty for individuals who are involved in voyeurism. Basically, people who are peeping or looking at, gazing at people without their knowledge. And members, I'm going to give you a very brief a synopsis of why this bill came to me. A constituent in my district whose ex-husband or stepfather was surreptitiously gazing at her through a two-way mirror in their home. This activity was taking place over a six-year period of time without her knowledge. When it was found that this activity was taking place, the stepfather was initially charged with four counts of interference with privacy, pled guilty to two counts, sentenced 185 days in jail and a $4,000 fine, served 120 days, and had all but $1,200 of the fine stayed. The stepfather was ordered to stay at least 1 mile away from his stepdaughter, but importantly was found and caught trying to peep at her the day after his release from jail. When we looked at the statute, the penalty for this was a misdemeanor. We're asking that through this file 2259 that this be increased to a gross misdemeanor, and that if you look on page 2 of the bill, that a person would be guilty of a felony if this action would continue. So, members, this bill is very straightforward. It has passed through the Senate Judiciary Committee and is on the Senate floor. Probably the most important thing to remember with this is there's a tremendous amount of scarring, emotional scarring that goes on when this type of activity takes place. At this point, Mr. Chairman and members, I will stand for any questions, but certainly would appreciate your support on this bill.
Okay, we'll do that. Representative Blaine, just to clarify, it's my understanding that the bill has passed the Senate and is in their omnibus crime bill. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm sorry, sir.
Standing alone on their floor. They've included it in their omnibus crime bill.
You are correct.
Okay, it would be my intent once we get through the testimony and questioning that we lay your bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think it's a great bill and wholeheartedly support it. My question is, how does it have a zero fiscal note when you're increasing penalties with a gross misdemeanor and then a felony?
Representative Blaine.
I had wondered about that, and I had used the fiscal note that I had received from the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they had no fiscal impact on this. If there is anybody in staff that could help me decipher that, I'd be more than happy for their insight.
Well, Representative Blaine and Representative Hillstrom, I'm looking at the consolidated fiscal note on the Senate version, completed February 26, and on page 3, there's an assumption made in preparation that according to the SGC, Sentencing Guidelines Commission, the number of gross misdemeanor convictions is very low, and it is assumed that when this offense becomes a felony, most offenders will receive probationary sentences. Any additional sentencing enhancements or new penalties will add to already overcrowded caseloads. The impact of this bill on the state prison resources is projected to be minimal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further? Okay. Representative, there is no further on my list. Representative Paymar?
Just a question on page 2, section 2D of the bill. I just want to make sure I understand what we're doing here because we're
I understand the felony provisions in 2E. Now we're changing the gross misdemeanor. When we talk about recording, amplifying, or broadcasting sounds or events through the window, what are we talking about here?
Representative Blaine, give us an example.
I think probably the best example would be if someone, let's say, had a tape recorder outside someone's the window of their home, and it dropped unknowingly dropped a microphone unknowingly to the occupants, had dropped a microphone in there, and recorded activities going on in there.
Representative Kamer, you've got the mic, but Representative Strawn, do you have an on-point answer or response?
To that point, Mr. Chair and Representative Kamer, increasing problem is those cell phones that take photographs, and they're being used in windows or in locker rooms, places like that, surreptitiously.
Representative Kamer.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lesch.
Oh, no, that's
good. Okay. Any further questions on House File 2259? Anyone in the audience want to be heard in testimony on 2259? Could you raise your hand? I see none. We're back on the bill, and it's before us. If there are no further questions, Chair lays it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to move reconsideration of Representative Meslow's bill, House File 2217.
Hang on.
Did we pass one?
Representative Lesch moves reconsideration of House File 2217. That is, that motion is before us. If this non-debatable motion, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. That bill is back before us.
Try again.
Representative Lesch, before we go back to the author, do you have anything further, or can we proceed? Representative Meslow? Representative Lesch?
No comments. I just want to vote again.
I think they call that a do-over.
Representative Meslow, the bill is before us. We've heard the description. Do you have anything further to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I thank you for the committee's indulgence, and I have with me now John Appetz, who's been listening avidly to the conversation, is here on behalf of the railroad.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is John Appetz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, short lines and regionals that run around the state. And I think I can speak for our railroad brethren as well on this particular issue. This is indeed one of sort of obvious common sense in terms of dealing with the mixture of automobiles and trains. It's a typically fatal mixture, and one which really needs to be avoided at just about any cost. There are in this state about 4,500 miles of railroad track, and there are about 4,200 grade crossings. That's where the track and the train come together at the street level, the vast majority of which are not controlled in any fashion, gates or otherwise. They have a sign, to the question about the sign earlier, and that sign kind of looks like this. You all know what that sign looks like. And at those crossings, the law basically says, stop. In this particular instance, if there's a warning, a flashing, or stop if you see a train coming. What Mr. Meslow's bill simply does is say, and don't go across that track until you can get across it, until you can get 10 feet safely across it. We've had some instances in the state where we have combined trains and cars where they haven't gotten across the track, that 10-foot margin that we're hoping to apply here. The Elk River situation was an extended truck. The truck pulled across. The truck didn't get across. The truck laid across the rail track and spun around when the train came in contact with it. Fortunately, the driver wasn't killed. We had another instance up in White Bear Lake where a driver, a woman came across the track, didn't get all the way across the track, and the train had the same effect on the car, and fortunately that person wasn't killed. But typically that's what happens. This is sort of straightforward common sense idea here that says, if you can't get across, don't go across. Get across when it's safe to get across, and we suggest that's about a 10-foot margin. I could labor this forward. I won't do that, simply to say that this is strongly endorsed by the railroads and people who are on fire services who've been to those situations where trains and cars mix, and we're trying to avoid any more of that fatal situation.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Abbott, you're saying that by passage of this bill, it's going to be a deterrent. It's going to keep the cars from going across when a train is coming.
Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, cars can't go across when there's a train coming. Cars can't go across now if there's a signal stop or if there is a, if you see a train coming. The law says stop, don't right. go across. It also says in instances where you have commercial vehicles or school buses, that sort of thing, they have to stop at every instance. All this says is when you stop, don't go across until you can safely get across.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Abbott. Okay, so they don't wait. With common sense, like Representative Fuller said, if they don't use their common sense and they don't wait, nothing more is going to happen except now they're going to total their car, maybe lose their life, and get a ticket, too.
Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's right.
If I might follow up on that, Mr. Chair.
Well, do you have further questioning, Representative Murphy?
Well, maybe Representative Meslow is anticipating and is going to follow up.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, to that point, the violation occurs whether a train hits the car or not. So to some extent, there are also circumstances where a ticket can be issued, and that becomes part of the public awareness as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wes Meslow, do you have police officers or people that issue tickets that are going to sit down there enough times so that word will get around that you really should use your common sense and stop and stay stopped at the railroad track?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is one of the conversations I would have with the White Bear Lake Police Department, is that we would try to do, first of all, a public relations campaign through the newspaper, and then particularly the intersection of Highways 96 and 61. We already have squad cars sitting there frequently because of people who are disobeying that stoplight, and I would expect our officers would watch for that as an additional violation and basically be using that as part of a public communications campaign.
Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, I would have a slightly different answer than Mr. Apitz and Mr. Meslow as to what this is about. In my judgment, if I could direct your attention and other committee members' attention to line 15, the standard of shall not proceed until safe to do so, if you're an injured person and litigating with the railroad over who was at fault, and indeed my firm had a case like this at a crossing. She tragically died as a result of a collision with a Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad car or engine. The standard shall not proceed until safe to do so is a invitation for legal experts on both sides to fight. We said it was safe. Clearly it was safe. They said it wasn't safe. Blah, 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 blah. A more definite standard, a pro-railroad standard, I would suggest, is not until the roadway is clear of traffic so that the vehicle can proceed at least without stopping, so that the rear of the vehicle is at least 10 feet past the farthest railroad track. That's a more definite, which perhaps is an improvement, but I think it's also a more generous standard, perhaps, than shall not proceed until safe to do so when the railroad litigates personal injury claims. And so, I think if I were to guess, not attributing bad motives, but if I were to guess, what this is really about is not an extra ticket for the injured family, but a way for Burlington Northern Santa Fe and other railroads to have a clearer, more generous standard so that they can kick personal injury claims out of court. That would be my view.
Thank you, Representative.
We have Representative Hilty next, and hopefully last. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I shouldn't bring this up, but the way this bill is drafted on page one, if you look at the old language beginning on line 18.
Which line?
Line 18, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
These requirements apply when, and then there's a list of whens. It would seem to me that the way this bill is drafted, the new language on page one is virtually meaningless, since it would only apply when the train was approaching, the lights were flashing, etc.
Might have flipped me.
Further comment from the author, or
nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion. Representative Strong.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I completely agree with Representative Lippman's statements, and all the better reason to vote for the bill.
Are we going to recess?
Are we going to recess, Mr. Chair, if we go past noon on this issue?
We will. We have an additional bill, and that is the answer is yes. Okay. Further discussion on the bill. House File 2217 on Representative Meslow's motion that it be recommended to pass and be referred and or passed over the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
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 Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yeah. Okay, committee, we're going to have to recess and take the final bill up at 1/2 hour after session.
The final bill is?
Say again.
And what is the final bill, Mr.?
That would be Representative Abler, House File 2436, Public Health Emergencies Policy Declaration Provided. The reason we have to do that is I was corrected. We simply don't have legal possession of the bill yet and won't until after session. Okay. So this committee stands in recess.
So the chair will move House File 2436 to
local government, Mr. Chair.
Pass and go to local government. Bill's before us. Why don't you begin your testimony? And I'm not sure, I'm not that familiar with what's in the bill, but if you could focus mostly on the things that are going to pertain to the Judicial Committee, I would appreciate that. So go ahead and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, just in very brief, and then I'll let the Commissioner get into the body of the comments. This is the reauthorization of the Emergency Health Powers Act. It's got a 4-year sunset. It had a 2-year before, and it was very controversial 2 years ago, and Doc Mulder spent a great deal of time and anguish dealing with me, especially, on the and others who had concerns. This is now the reauthorization, and since then, SARS has come about, which offers a whole new realistic flavor to why we might need this bill, which has kind of helped me come on board. And the Health Department has been very good at listening to my concerns and the concerns of almost everybody else who had concerns to make this a very clean, good bill. The parts that you're going to be concerned about here will be, I'll let the Commissioner talk about that. So, thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Would you just state your name for the record and then proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I believe the sections for this committee tonight are sections 8, 12, 13, and 15. Section 8 is related to security data, It allows the Department of Health and others involved in emergency preparedness to share security information, which are things like home phone numbers or our emergency plan or the locations of supplies, and to do that in a secure sort of way. Section 12 and 13 is basically the same language. It describes the authority for peace officers to enforce the commissioner's order or the court order for isolation or quarantine. It also describes the level of force that can be used, which is necessary, reasonable force but not deadly force in order to enforce an order for isolation or quarantine. And the other section that is an issue for this committee is Section 15, which is about judicial procedures. And that authorizes the court hearings for the challenge to whether someone should be in isolation or quarantine or the conditions under which a person is being held. But those court hearings can be held by the telephone or by interactive video conference, so that that can be done quickly and addresses some of the infection control procedures that you might have with someone with a communicable disease. Mr. Chair, that's the end of my overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, committee. Anybody have any questions or comments or thoughts on the sections? We're looking at Section 6, or pardon me, Section 8, 12, 13, and 15. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Adler, would a person who was detained be allowed to have counsel to assist them if they were involuntarily detained under the statute?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the bill that was passed in 2002 does affirm the individual's right to counsel. Not all of those pieces are here in this adjustment, but it is included in the bill that would be authorized and continued.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ellison?
Yeah, we discussed that, I believe, earlier, and I just want to make sure that there was still provision in here for people who may find themselves on the business end of this statute, who may need to get some relief. For people who, does the statute allow for people to get counsel, whether or not they're indigent, or is it only indigent?
Mr. Chair. Representative, the statute doesn't address the payment for the counsel. We have been working with Ramsey County to establish a defense counsel or a defense panel similar to what's available for mental health, so that we have some attorneys who are up to speed and ready to go.
Okay, Representative Meswell had a comment to that point.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would call the committee's attention to page 13. Lines 26 through 28, and it does indicate that existing law provides for a right to counsel, including the right, if indigent, to be represented by counsel. So I believe that addresses Representative Ellison's concerns.
Yeah, it does. Thank you for that, Representative Nesbitt.
Representative Fuller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler, so I know this hasn't changed. If we get into a situation where we're dealing with this section of statute, and the governor declares the emergency, we automatically are in very short fashion. This body's in special session, and we're all down here ready and able to make decisions as needed.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, if the 2002 language says that if the legislature is not in session, then at the time the governor issues an emergency declaration, he must call the legislature into session.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Look, Mr. Chair, just to give full disclosure, there is some provisions for doing some things beyond that determination of an emergency, and that's what the whole SARS thing got us thinking about. What if you have a small deal, you don't want to put the big hammer down? And so what are some incremental steps you can take? And there's some powers that are spelled out about that for how to handle people on a plane coming back from China that probably have SARS and so on like that.
Let's hope it never happens.
Pretty good.
Do we have any other questions? Any? Representative Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, was there a motion on where this is going to go?
Yes, we go to local government.
Okay. And Representative Abler, after this left Health and Human Services policy, what has happened to the bill since it left there?
Representative Abler?
It's had a wonderful dry ride through a whole bunch of committees. It had a little bonus addition in the Commerce Committee, the county ability to, the local government ability to pool into some long-term care groups is added, I believe, at the end. There's been a few other amendments offered along the way. I don't remember the specific ones. In civil law, there was some substantial work with some terms I've forgotten now. I'm a chiropractor, not a lawyer. Having to do with
the judicial
stuff that
judicial immunity.
Yeah, it was some immunity matters, and we cleared up some. We took out four sentences that clarified who would be covered under immunities, and that's about what we did.
Follow up, Mr. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to add that this is a very important bill for the state of Minnesota. We need to be prepared in case situations like these would arise. They are extraordinary powers that we normally wouldn't do. However, in an act of in a declared emergency by the governor, things have to happen fairly quickly. Consequently, I can understand that it would be going through several committees, and I would just ask that, and to make sure the author that, and just have assurances from the author that as this thing goes to the committee, that it remain a bill that is clean, that does what we need to do, and doesn't wander too far afield. And that's just advice for the author. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and committee, it has one more committee left, and I think we're done. So that's a good chance of that happening, Mr. Paul.
Representative Abler, on page 6, maybe you could do a little more clarification of on page 6, lines 4 through 15, the access of information is granted almost entirely to the government entity to do whatever they want with it. Do you want to comment on that a little bit, or what the need for that is? It seems pretty wide open.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, if you read it carefully, there's that what they're sharing is data known as security information, which is spelled out very clearly, and the commissioner can offer more insight. But it's general information about first responders, what hospitals are available, contact information. It's nothing to do with health data or personal data at all. It's data that would assist preparedness. And the reason it's not only provided for during an emergency is because in terms of preparation for an emergency, you want to have some response systems intact. So part of the challenge is to have the communications and the preparedness present, and that's what this is about. And perhaps the commissioner can elaborate if that's not good enough.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Representative Abler said, this is information that you don't want the bad guys to get, basically. It's where do we keep our supplies? How do we reach our volunteers? What are the phone numbers? How do we, what's our emergency plan? How will we be interacting? Who's going to be doing what? Some of those things. That's the kind of information that we'd like to be able to share with our partners.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? And anybody from the audience that would like to comment or has something they'd like to bring to our attention? Okay, we have one person. Okay, why don't you come up to the mic, sir, and why don't you state your name for the record and go ahead and with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Haugen from the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. Just to be brief and to speak to the addition to the bill, Section 9 concerns long-term care insurance. This is something that just very briefly I want to clarify is not a DOER initiative. It's not a role we have sought. There would be some cost to Dewar from taking on the additional local units of government as part of the long-term care insurance provisions of the bill. So I just wanted to offer that clarification for the committee.
Okay, and I think that would probably be an HHS finance issue primarily.
Maybe dealt with later, Mr. Chair.
State government? Okay. Unless there's any other any other questions on that issue, Mr. Haugen? Okay, see no other questions. Representative Murphy.
I don't have another question, but I just don't jump on the vote yet.
Okay.
And I don't have anything to say either, but I'm trying to read this. We've just had such a short time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fuller.
Maybe Representative Abler could just tell us a little bit more about the committee process and how much fun he's had going through each of the committees and their votes, maybe if they were close or not, to give us a little entertainment while we read the bill further.
Mr. Chair, I could comment on that. It's been a wonderful experience. There's a few committees I've missed. And I think when we get to the floor, we won't need much discussion because they've all heard the bill at least once. Anyway, just to offer what has gone on, I don't know if I mentioned that there's been a number of concerns raised by this by the various entities. We've tried to roll every concern we can into some positive response. ranging from, we were trying to work under the old law even a little bit to see where that had gone too far. And part of the reason why I wanted to have a four-year sunset as well as opposed to an indefinite permanent bill is that as these situations evolve, we won't know what we need to do until the matters arise. When you have a sunset, then you have to act. And that seems, we seem to be pushed into action by having to do things. Since the last sunset time, SARS has evolved, which gave us a whole new impetus to think about how to have a little hammer and a very little fine-tuning of these powers and how to sequester a few people. In Toronto, was it 27,000 people were having to be sequestered, and they were sequestered in their homes. Only 30 people needed a little extra help to be reminded that they needed to stay in their homes, which is a very small percentage. And so we have to find a way to respectfully treat the 27,000, as well as how do you fairly and without undue harm to people's lives address the 30. For the sake of Mr. Representative Walls, they can't use deadly force. So they can stay there, but they have to kind of find a better way. So tell them bad jokes or whatever you might do to kind of keep them in there. We also worked on some job protections. And so if you're required to be in a quarantine, we tightened up even who is protected when they're in a quarantine with their job situation. You have to be ordered to go there. And under someone's direction, you can't just decide you want to take 3 weeks off of work and go back to your job. If you're an employer of more than 20 people and you're in a quarantine, if you're employed by a company of more than 20 people and you're in quarantine 21 days, your job will be secure. There's even remedies in case they don't do that correctly for you. And so that's just a little bit of highlights about the bill as well. We've tried to be, if you have thoughts after you read the bill later on and have some more advice, I think there's still time to accept that. So we want this to be the best bill, the cleanest, tightest bill with the least harm to the least number of people we possibly can make it, given the terrible situation that it anticipates.
Okay, Representative Abler, we've got some questions now. So.
I can go on longer.
Good job, Representative Abler.
Very good job of filling time here and giving us a chance to read the bill. Okay, we got Representative Paul Blaine and then Ellison. So, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since the Department of Employment Relations came up and stated that this wasn't a departmental initiative, that it was enacted during the Commerce Department, and perhaps Representative Abler would like to explain that addition that happened during the Commerce Department hearing.
Section 9.
That's Section 9.
Yeah, actually, I can do that, Mr. Chair. There's I'll tell you a part of it, and then a part of it Representative Paul and I should discuss more privately, because part of it has to do with the matter that I'd rather not discuss at the microphone. The situation was that the long-term care bill was to be discontinued in that committee, and so in the spirit of health powers and emergencies and commandeering vehicles, the health department graciously offered a ride to this bill to carry it to the next step along the way. So that's a little bit facetious, but it was simply a matter of allowing this bill to go on. The point of this is, I'll talk about long-term care insurance. One of the things that we're trying to accomplish with long-term care work that I've been working on for several years is to find ways to have more people take a part in that very essential component, so that we can get out of the business of having people spend out of poverty, and then get on the and then spend their last year or two on the state programs with no resources anymore. And so if we can find ways that people can keep their resources and their dignity and plan, that's what the bill is about. And so it was a very important bill, and it just kind of ran afoul of some procedures. And so that's how it wound up in the bill. But the bill itself, I think, is very important and will allow municipal and county employees to pool with the state in an effort to attract more people to buy long-term care insurance.
Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Vaylor, I'm just curious what the status is with this bill on the Senate side.
Representative Vaylor.
The commissioner might know. It's I don't know the exact status. I'll just defer to the commissioner, because she's been following this very closely.
Commissioner Lighthouse.
Representative, it's being heard tomorrow in Health Policy Committee. And starting on its path.
And for the sake of the minute, this is going to wind up in rules, just so you know. So that's its destination after government, after local government.
Is it any follow-up, Representative Blaine? That's it. Here, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Representative Abel, but as I'm looking at the definition of security information, I'm having trouble thinking of an example of what that would be. It's, you know, in this handout, you, not you, but whoever the author of it is, states that, okay, security information is defined as information that, if disclosed, would be likely to substantially jeopardize the security of information possessions, individuals, or property against theft, illegal disclosure, or physical injury. It includes names and home addresses of individuals who participate in community crime prevention programs. Could you sort of elaborate on what security information actually is? I'm having a little trouble getting my mind wrapped around the concept.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Security information, as we've been working on this issue and working with the Department of Public Safety, are things like the list of home phone numbers of our volunteers. We need to activate volunteers to help with a vaccination clinic or to provide care to people in an isolation unit or things to be able to protect those individuals and to protect their the list of those individuals. We may need to provide that list to the hospital so that they can contact those people, so we'd like the authority to be able to share that information.
So, Mr. Chair, so actually security information is identifying information about health, emergency health, or health people, or emergency personnel, whether health or whatever, that is normally kept secret but would be disclosed so that institutions that serve people in an emergency can access those people. Is that right?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, that would be one of the kinds. It could also be the location of our supplies, or it could be our emergency plan for what protocols or procedures. So it's not just people. It may be things and places and procedures and protocols.
All right.
Representative Paul, will you have another question?
Well, I just wanted to clarify and just make sure that this data could only be shared under a declared emergency. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe it's both during an emergency or preparation for an emergency. It may be that before the event we'd want to be able to give information to people engaged in or temporarily assisting with preparedness or response. Page 6, line 9.
Very good. And, Mr. Chairman, I just want to stress here that these are extraordinary circumstances where we do have to respond in a quick and prompt manner. This section allows it to happen quickly. It's an important section of the bill, and I urge the support of the committee for this section. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, Commissioner, can you tell me if this act was imposed or and the security information became in effect and you had these people that had these new emergency powers, how long would they be able to use them who determines when the emergency's over and they can't use these things anymore?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, when an emergency is declared by the governor, it has the maximum of 30 days. The legislature is called into session when he declares an emergency. The legislature has the power to terminate an emergency. If the governor wants to continue it beyond 30 days, he needs to declare a new emergency. And again, if the legislature is not in session, he needs to call the legislature into session.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, what happens if the emergency was over in 2 days? Would those people then cease using their emergency powers
and Commissioner Lighthouser.
Security information?
Mr. Chair, and Representative, the governor can not only declare the emergency, but he can stop an emergency at any time. And the requirements for what constitutes a public health emergency, which is the kind of emergency we're talking about, are fairly limited and restricted. It's a bioterrorism or an infectious disease related to a new or previously controlled infectious agent, and it has the likelihood or the potential or the actual impact of a large number of deaths or a large number of disabilities. So it's a very limited definition under which you can declare this. If the governor declares an emergency and it's no longer valid, the emergency is over, then he declares that the emergency stops, or the legislature in session can terminate the emergency. And there's two ways for that to happen.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
Commissioner, and the governor gets its information from these people out on the lines, huh?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy, the governor is to consult with the Commissioner of Health, the Commissioner of Public Safety, with tribal authorities, with local government, as he does for regular peacetime or national security emergencies.
Seeing no other questions, are we ready for the question? Okay, the chair then renews the motion that House File 2436 pass and move to local government committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion passes, or the bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. And this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.